This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. Go to FUBARradio.com for more details.
FUBAR Radio presents
Politics on FUBAR.
Good afternoon and welcome to Politics on FUBAR. It's Asa Bennett here. Now, what a week it has been. It's really just culminating. It was a drumbeat increasing as we go towards today. G20 summit, the supergroup of world leaders, the most powerful ones around, all gathering in Hamburg for a big powwow. And so you have the sort of personality clashes like you've never seen before. Sort of Donald Trump on the one side from America, Vladimir Putin, the sort of enigmatic Russian president, who lifelong president seemingly, it seems. For the other side. And you might think, hang on, given the recent reports during the election campaign that actually Russia may have been having some interest in Trump being elected, that it might be quite fascinating, the dynamic there when you see Trump sort of coming in to meet Putin. Perhaps it'll be like he's reporting in for a job interview, a sort of a couple of months in, seeing his boss, you might think, see how he's doing. Nonetheless, he has to publicly, though, talk big, puff his chest up, and see what he can get out of Russia in terms of, you know, sort of whether it be a Cold War, whether he instead will get to thaw things, because he said before that, you know, if we can get along with Russia, that's just great. That's perfect. And at the same point for this president, he's someone who really loves people paying attention to him. The way during the campaign he giggled with joy, like someone's tickled his tummy when Putin said some nice things about him, suggested that he was a strong candidate. Showed that was a way to really cut to his ego. And yet the Russian inscrutability means that he, you know, is an asset for them, because then Trump can flail around. He's transparent as anything. You know what he wants. But Putin, far more Sphinx-like, in a sense. And as well as this, of course, there were all sorts of reports about Russia and intervention like this, with the idea of hacking perhaps going on, which actually is a theme that we're going to be exploring this week, cybersecurity and hacking. Given that, after all, is what seemingly suggested as inquest investigations pile on top of each other, that maybe there was sort of a special Putin-like intervention. He commissioned and asked people perhaps to just spam out fake news, maybe, to help his old comrade get elected into the White House. And it's obviously not, as some people might say, hacking in a sense of jiggery-pokery with voting machines, but merely just making the sort of noises on social media more helpful for Trump and his narrative. And given this, it is still funny, because reports suggest now that Obama may not have been so vigilant when he heard from his security chiefs that there may have been Russian interest in the election. And then Trump now turns around and says, why did you not sort of act? You choked. You really didn't act. You just wanted, you know, crooked Hillary to win. And it just sort of shows the bizarrety of Trump's world. Now, on the one hand, he'd like people to think that, yes, there may have been some sort of hacking. It may have been Russia or to some other country. Or, as he one point said, a fat guy who weighs 400 pounds sitting on his bed at home or something. But, you know, who knows? It's definitely not Russia, though. Stop talking about Russia. It's just a distraction, smokescreen, you know, sad and all that. So this is the kind of curious logic we now find ourselves in. And yet it's not all about America. Don't worry. This show is not to be focused on American politics and all that happens, mainly because we now find that hacking and threats to cybersecurity are a global phenomenon, given that just a couple of days ago, we saw the NHS attacked by ransomware, in that their services, their computer systems have ground to a halt, with, it seems, screens popping up, demanding money, sent through Bitcoin, in a sense, for it to be fully operational. And even, actually, our own Houses of Parliament, they were afflicted by hackers in that sense, too. Although not in the same sense of being held to ransom, as peculiar as it might be, it seemed to be a more functional point, where they couldn't log in from remote working or something, so they instead might have had to go into the office. Well, hey, brilliant. But it still meant that during the weekend they insisted that it was impossible to log in, and so the cogs of democracy did grind to a halt. And then the questions do pile on, because with our own sort of attacks that have happened, you know, what computer systems did we have? You might think it's easy, just update your systems and then you're protected. Here we go. But actually, you found that in some corners, like 90% of NHS trusts has a 15-year-old Windows operating program. Not top of the line, let's put it that way. So all sorts of fascinating questions spring forth from that. And so with cybersecurity hot on our minds, I have the pleasure also to later on be sort of debating the question of this week, which is Britain safe enough from hackers? We've put the question out on Twitter. The answers have been piling in. Make sure your voice is heard. And also, if you don't want to answer the poll, well, by all means, actually do. Instead, you can feel free to tweet at FUBAR Radio or email your thoughts to politics@fubarradio.com, and we'll feed this through in to the show as we go. And also, by the way, at the end of the show, we'll be having a special interview with Baroness Pauline Neville-Jones, who was former security minister in the David Cameron's government and former chair of the Joint Intelligence Committee, basically the committee responsible for overseeing all sorts of intelligence and really making the crucial decisions. So the things she has seen, I can only imagine. She probably won't say very much of them due to Official Secrets Act and all sorts of things and on pain of death, but we might see nonetheless. The insights will come to the fore throughout the show. And so, after talking about this news, the latest news, I have the distinct pleasure to welcome, after this sort of coming up next, we'll be reviewing the week's news with Hannah Flint, and we'll be speaking to her after this short break.
FUBAR Radio presents
Sarah Love and My Sticky.
In this last week, we had some shocking news that a prodigy of Mobb Deep, he died on the 20th of June. He was only 42 years old, man. You know, to me, they define like a whole era of hip hop. And to me, Mobb Deep, really, they are the sound of New York hip hop. They became one of the most successful rap duos in hip hop, having sold over 3 million records. And I mean, what an amazing contribution they have made. So I thought it was only correct that we sent out an enormous
big up
to Prodigy.
Every Monday,
Sarah Love and My Sticky.
From 4 p.m.
FUBAR Radio.
And welcome back to Politics on FUBAR. It's Asa Bennett here, and I have in the studio Hannah Flint, the journalist and writer. Welcome.
Hello. Thanks
now,
for having me.
Well, pleasure. And sort of, so you've got a spate of stories that you've been taking our attention. I mean, should we start maybe with the G20 first off?
Sure.
Because it seems very curious in that all the leaders are there, the sort of entourage is sort of, are in full aplomb. And I was amused to read at one point that apparently the Saudi Arabian entourage, they've got sort of camels and a golden escalator.
Yeah, I heard about this. I sort of read this and I was like, how? I just don't understand how you get that through customs. Like, a golden escalator, that sounds...
And sort of camel milk as well.
Yeah.
And supplies. And they booked hotels out too. I mean, my word. You think with the preparation that has to happen...
Yeah.
You know, Donald Trump, he's done what instead?
He forgot to book.
Awkward.
He's the only one who hasn't managed to book a hotel room, which is kind of ironic considering his profession, original profession before he was president. He couldn't find a hotel room in Hamburg, but so he's ended up doing, I suppose, the political equivalent of an Airbnb. He's ended up in the Hamburg Senate Guest House, which is a lovely building. Here, I've got this. I'll show you there.
Oh,
nice building.
Very swanky.
Very swanky.
He's not going to be sleeping on a sofa. Let's assume that. You know,
no. Maybe he'll have to give ratings afterwards. I wonder what they'd say. What would he get?
I don't know. He'd be thinking that perhaps the sort of the door handles way too big for my hands. Oh no, obviously my hands are huge. It's fine. Loved it there.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was a huge mistake of him not booking hotels. Kind of sad.
Yeah, no,
really sad. Yeah, really, yeah. Really sad. Oh my God, Donald Trump, pull it together.
But you know, one day, of course, he has built so many hotels. You would think surely there must be one in Germany he can name drop and go and live in.
Well, apparently he was supposed to have the one that the Saudi Arabian posse were going to have. And the worst thing about it for him is that the king isn't even coming. He isn't turning up.
Yes.
His minister's coming instead. So they've got the whole hotel and he can't get one.
And he would love to be seeing the golden escalator and the camels.
I'm just waiting for him to tweet something against like Saudi Arabia or break some sort of agreement they have now because of that absolute snub.
Well, these things do matter for him in his world. It is shocking. But then that said, close to home, obviously, while we're thinking more about Britain rather than sort of Hamburg, maybe I'm just envious about not getting to go to sort of see such a glitz and glam. Things aren't very well in the Labour Party right now. And that's sort of Luciana Berger seems to be being accosted in Liverpool Wavertree by her own supporters.
Yeah, it's kind of sad. I mean, to be honest, let's take away... I mean, she's on maternity leave now.
Fine.
Obviously, snap election wasn't the greatest time for her. But take that away from her. You know, she's a mother, you know, a woman. But the fact is, she's been elected. She's been re-elected. She increased her majority. And for what's happening within the local party where certain positions in the executive council has been taken over by Momentum supporters, for them to kind of say that she needs to get on board and she has to run by every parliamentary vote decision that she wants to make by them seems a bit much, seems a bit unfair. And actually, you know, there's a lot of people within local constituencies who have decided they want her to represent them. They want her to be the voice, not 10 council members.
Because her majority has been increased in the
last
few
elections. Yeah, I think it's 5,000.
Yeah.
I know, I've, I mean...
She answers to voters.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. And this is the big thing. I mean, I'm a Labour supporter. I was
Do you sympathise with Momentum or Luciana in this round?
Luciana, for sure. Because I just feel like, you know... If you're elected to Parliament, you're voted in by your constituents. And from when I've been out doing some canvassing on the Labour's doorstep, especially in Doncaster, a lot of Labour members aren't Corbyn fans. You know, they don't support him. Some of them have said that they wouldn't vote. And I'm not saying that's everywhere. Obviously, there's been a big support, and that's great that we've got people out. But I think...
Well, we are talking in Jeremy Corbyn's backyard in Islington.
Yeah, so I know.
Well, I think the majority of, 40,000 or something ridiculous.
And I mean, look in London, Diane Abbott increased her majority. And I mean, she's had her ups and downs over the last few months. But I think if what we're creating is more differences in the Labour Party. We're not coming together. We need to come together now because the end goal is to get Labour back into government. And if we're constantly having these infightings and having been told that you're not left enough or you're not behind Jeremy Corbyn, you're taking away actually your fundamental right to have an opinion. Imagine if back in the day, during Tony Blair's government, imagine they said, sorry, Jeremy, if you don't get involved with our policies, you're out. You're going to get done for re-selection. That shouldn't happen because actually you need to remember that MPs are representative of that area. They've worked in that area for a long time. People trust them. Obviously, the new people come in and there's a loss of trust. But we need to make sure that we're not going to become too tyrannical in the whole situation.
But what fuels, I think, the momentum of activists here is so tragic in that sense, because I mean they would actually say, hang on, during the Tony Blair era, our man Jezza was reviled at like some weirdy beardy little, so he'd come on and he'd get laughed at and he'd fumble around doing his own thing, and then all these MPs come in with their no confidence votes and not thinking he's electable. Well, he is electable. We didn't win in the last election, but we did better than people think, and so they seem to be wanting some sort of revenge on some people. It's a bit seedy. They're going for Luciana, of course, who's a prominent Jewish MP as
I know.
Well.
And it's kind of, it's not really
she
kind
was
of
trolling last year. I think
I remember earlier on this year when was it Emma Barnett who called Corbyn out during an interview because he didn't have his facts and figures, and then there was a separate Twitter account that started saying
I hear she's a Zionist.
And it's kind of, what has that got to do with anything? I think if anything, Corbyn needs to take a bit more control of these people who are supporting him, and some of them are great people. You cannot tar them all with the same brush, and I can't tar Corbyn that brush because I do think he has been a good MP and stood up for himself for the last however many years in politics. So I just hope that we can get to a point where we can take these party political differences aside to get forward and move forward Labour message, and hopefully there isn't an election later this year, because I don't think we could all handle another election. But next time it comes around, in 3 years' time, 3 years, four years' time, we have a united front that actually can get us back into government.
But it's so... Again, I struggle to understand this, why they have to feel this way, in a sense, because they seem to be wanting to have an oath of loyalty.
I feel like you should have a loyalty to the Labour Party, not an individual, because as you know, people can move different leaders. Fair enough, he won the second one against Owen Smith, fine, but we should have loyalty to the party and also your fundamental values. I think that's the key thing about this. As long as you're doing what you said you were going to go out when you became an MP, what you did when the election came forward and you got voted in, that's who you should show your loyalty to, your constituents.
Completely. And obviously Jeremy has been laudable in at least saying, I condemn hate speech and bullying in all its forms and all that sort of slight catch-all terms. But then Luciana Berger, Emma Barnett, as you were saying, it seems that some of these very excitable Momentum supporters have a problem with, eloquent, passionate women. They don't really do this in the same volume and intensity to men.
I agree. I think the way that the media, the way that lots of men in the parties, and this isn't just Labour, this is everywhere. I think there is a derision to women in politics that we need to be continually talking about and actually pointing out and calling it out. And actually, it's all good having women speak about it and say this is wrong, but we do need men on side to actually say this is wrong, these should not be treated this way, and we should all be given a fair voice. It doesn't matter if you're a man or a woman or Jewish, you know.
Definitely. I mean,
or Muslim or anything. Equality, guys.
All voices are welcome here, you know. Yeah. So thank you. That's why maybe I was just listening, you know, attentively to what you were saying.
I appreciate this. Thank you.
At least I can do. Now, sort of, nonetheless, if people listening are wanting also to get involved, by all means do sort of tweet at Fubar Radio or email politics@fubarradio.com. And I'm afraid that's all we have time for with Hannah, but thank you so much for sharing
the
time.
Thank you so much.
And so, you know, have a good day. And in the meantime, we'll be starting our conversation talking about hacking and cybersecurity with Paul Carden, very clever man from London South Bank University. But first, let's look to the United States and think about the really consistent lines and rhetoric we've had from President Trump. And now he's responded to cyber threats, Russia and all that, over the past 12 months.
We have to get very, very tough on cyber and cyber warfare. It is a huge problem. The security aspect of cyber is very, very tough, and maybe it's hardly doable. But I will say we are not doing the job we should be doing. But that's true throughout our whole governmental society.
It would be interesting to see. I will tell you this. Russia, if you're listening, I hope you're able to find the 30,000 emails that are missing. I think you will probably be rewarded mightily by our press. Let's see if that happens. That'll be next. Yes, sir.
Will you once and for all, yes or no, definitively say that Russia interfered in the 2016 election?
I think it was Russia, and I think it could have been other people in other countries. Could have been a lot of people interfered. I said it very simply. I think it could very well have been Russia, but I think it could well have been other countries, and I won't be specific, but I think a lot of people interfere. I think it's been happening for a long time. It's been happening for many, many years. Now, the thing I have to mention is that Barack Obama, when he was president, found out about this in terms of if it were Russia, found out about it in August. Now, the election was in November. That's a lot of time. He did nothing about it. Why did he do nothing about it? He was told it was Russia by the CIA, as I understand it. It was well reported. And he did nothing about it. They say he choked. Well, I don't think he choked. I think what happened is he thought Hillary Clinton was going to win the election, and he said, let's not do anything about it. Had he thought the other way, he would have done something about it. So, and if he thought I was going to win, he would have done plenty about it. So that's the real question, is why did he do nothing from August all the way to November 8th? Why did he do nothing? I agree. I think it was Russia, but I think it was probably other people and or countries, and I see nothing wrong with that statement. Nobody really knows. Nobody really knows for sure.
No one really knows for sure who did it, apparently, President Trump says. But we have someone who really knows, not who did it, I must make clear, but someone who just knows generally many things indeed about sort of hacking, cybersecurity, and all the related issues. Paul Carden, Senior Lecturer in Computer Science and Informatics at the London South Bank University. Hello.
Hello, Asa.
Now, so hacking is a very sort of catch-all term. Obviously, it seems to cover everything now. You could say, oh, the Russians, they hacked the election. One Labour MP, Ben Bradshaw, said it probably hacked the EU referendum. And it's so much more. What is hacking these days?
Hacking varies from an isolated individual operating in the comfort of their home and not necessarily being a geek or a knowledgeable person on IT, who downloads exploits and tools that allow them to attack other systems. That's one end of the scale. And then you can have organized groups such as criminal gangs or even state-sponsored groups that can launch highly sophisticated distributed attacks using lots of other systems to coordinate that. So they can bring down systems, they can exploit vulnerabilities into any machine that's on the internet.
Then, so how do you hack an election?
Well,
not a point by point guide.
Yeah. But, yeah. You can, if you can get access to whatever systems are being used for, say, for example, online voting, or you can attack, bring down positive sites that are pro a particular party or individual that you want to attack and bring down. You can also link up with. You can use bots and basically machines that will do the work for you rather than relying on an individual to be sitting there doing the attacking and automated. And the power of computers comes into play And you can get a
so
lot
sort of
out
of denial of service style
yes,
things.
Yeah, yes.
I mean, because then just to establish as well, because some corners of Twitter would probably have you think this is possible. I mean, is it possible then to sort of hack a voting machine?
If that machine,
because Americans, I think they use voting machines.
Yeah. Yeah. If that voting machine is using a standard piece of software, then it will have most likely vulnerabilities. And once you get in your information gathering. Get sufficient information to give you access to that, such as its IP address or what software it's running, then you can exploit that. There are various what we call attack surfaces, which is weaknesses in the chain of command to do with, say, that election system. That can be something as innocent as a person's LinkedIn profile, where they talk about, for example, what machines they manage, and that can reveal information for the hacker. You can search servers that are out there looking for particular types of file, and they can reveal passwords. And even if you get an encrypted password, there are websites out there that allow you to decrypt those passwords in seconds. So there is, because
speaking from personal experience, I had a an account with a sort of let's call it a popular ride sharing app, and it was very spooky a couple of months ago, because my phone suddenly blinked into life and it said, you've got a cab coming. Oh, it's in Australia. And I was thinking, oh my days, why is it I'm not in Australia? What the heck's wrong with you, sort of thing. And it emerged, obviously, clearly, I Googled my details, and obviously the company recommended I change my account details. Naturally, I did. And then I found my details on some dark corner of .ru Russian forum, alongside about 300 addresses of all sorts of other people, and it was just shocking. And I was thinking, how on earth? It seems so easy.
Yes,
people keep doing it.
It is quite. There are some shocking. I recently became GCHQ certified, and part of it was the information gathering process, and it was an eye opener. For example, the other night. Not doing anything illegal. I was using publicly available systems to see what a particular person was looking at on their set-top box. That information might seem trivial, but a social engineer will look for something to extract from that. Backups of people's WhatsApp photographs, webcams.
How on earth did you do that?
There is a form of information gathering called Google hacking, and this can give you this information. There was a website in America. I was able to view a backup of their database, which revealed administration passwords, users' accounts. And there are tools such as Malt Ego, which allow you to transform a Facebook ID into lots of other information, say what Facebook quotes did they like, or what tweets did they like, what are they a member of, email addresses, etc. And it's in seconds.
That's stunning. Because then if I could maybe explore for the final question, just because it does seem a sort of crushing inevitability that, the NHS gets hacked, Parliament gets hit. Name anywhere, the popular brands, M&S, I think, had loads of passwords, sort of leaked somewhere. Is it ever? We're in a race, clearly, yes. Against hackers. They try and develop, we have portholes, like holes in the Death Star, practically. They sweep their X-Wing in and they infiltrate. Will we ever plug these holes? Will we ever feel safe from hackers?
We will never be 100% safe, because there's a race with hardware and software constantly trying to catch up with each other. There are companies trying to get new technologies out, and that inevitably leads to corner cutting. There are, as well, I've mentioned online systems, ways of attack. There's also physical attack. I mean, to you, that might look like a USB stick that I'm holding in my hand, but it is actually equivalent to a keyboard that can type 1,000 words a minute. So if you leave the room for 2 minutes, I'm not leaving this room.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I plug this into your USB port, I can have it exploited and compromise without you having any idea.
So in
that's
a sense,
that's what we're up against. We're up against multiple attack vectors, multiple attack surfaces, where people will. So you have to think like a hacker to protect your company, to protect yourself. Even on the way here, I saw a gap in the tube advertising, and I thought, I could easily put a fake website up there, and anybody who gets on this tube, that's the way a hacker thinks. They think, what's my opportunity here?
I mean, because listening to this as well, I mean, some listeners may well, they may be amateur hackers in the audience, but equally some of them may just think, oh my gosh, I'm still a bit spooked by Blu-ray or sort of something. So besides the obvious tips of making sure your password isn't password, and I'm sorry if people have that, I mean to change it right now, and making sure it's a bit more complex password, not going on to sort of dodgymcdodgewebsite.com instead of checking it's a real website. Is there anything else you need to be aware of, finally?
Yes, I think if listeners, if they have not changed their at home, for example, their router password, then they should do so immediately, because there is a website called routerpasswords.com, which gives an attacker your default username and password. I'd also say if you're going to public Wi-Fi, which can be quite dangerous, make sure you don't do anything confidential, or make sure it's a secure website. Use a VPN. There's plenty of material online about how to get a VPN that will protect you, encrypt your any passwords and usernames that you are sending. But ultimately, think like an evil hacker, and that will be half the battle.
I'm sure our listeners will enjoy that thought experiment. Thank you very much, Paul, for your time.
Thank you.
And so coming up next is our studio debate on internet hacking, cybersecurity, and online safety. We'll be joined in the studio by Josiah Mortimer, editor of Left Foot Forward, Dr. Amir El Namrat, the cybersecurity researcher and lecturer at the University of East London, and Viv Groskop, the writer and comedian, to answer the question, is Britain safe enough from hackers? But first, let's hear from some politicians here in the UK and see how they've responded to recent cyber attacks on the NHS and Parliament itself.
In May, the NHS was hit by a cyber attack believed to be launched by a group known as Lazarus. Theresa May had this to say.
What is crucial in terms of cybersecurity is that it is this government that has actually put £2 billion into cybersecurity strategy, set up the National Cybersecurity Centre, that has been advising organisations in the public sector like the NHS, but outside the public sector as well, about cybersecurity. And going forward, we will ensure that the National Cybersecurity Centre is able to continue to advise and support.
When parliamentary emails were hacked last month and up to 90 email accounts compromised, the Secretary of State for International Trade, Liam Fox, said the following.
It is not a surprise that such an attack would take place, nor is it surprising that there would be some weaknesses, because people don't take basic precautions in having a complex enough password for their computer systems.
Another concern for the government is end-to-end encryption, as explained by the Home Secretary, Amber Rudd.
We are making good progress with the companies who have put in place end-to-end encryption. Some of them are being more constructive than others, but we will continue to build on that. The area that I'm most concerned about is the internet companies who are continuing to publish the hate publications, the hate material that is contributing to radicalising people in this country. What we're doing is challenging the people who are developing and delivering end-to-end encryption to work with us so that we have a way of keeping people safe. Nobody wants terrorists to have a safe place to exchange information and to be able to plot their terrible atrocities. I believe we can get them to be more successful in working with us to find a way of getting some of that information. So we're continuing to build on better relationships with the internet, to ask them, as the experts, to make those changes so that people don't get radicalised and the terrorists don't have somewhere to hide.
All right, well, that's how the UK politicians think. But what about the experts? I've got plenty of them in the studio right now. Sort of Josiah Mortimer, editor of Left Foot Forward, hello.
Hi.
And Dr. Amir El Namrat, also welcome.
Hi.
And finally, Viv Groskop, hello. And we'll all be here to discuss cybersecurity. So it sort of seems very funny in this world that we have, you know, ministers saying, make sure you remember your passwords. And like Amber Rudd gave an interview, Dr. El Namrat, on sort of how she wants experts with the necessary hashtag knowledge to sort of come forward and help. Do you think the government gets what to do to fight hackers?
Actually, they are trying. I mean, when they started in 2011 with the National Security Strategy, and they have allocated 860, I think, 8 billions to do, millions, sorry, to do so. However, I mean, this strategy ended up in 2015, and it was like a kind of evaluation of this strategy. And the government maybe according to the report, they have achieved almost half of their goals, I mean, in order to make UK resilient and try to establish a secure cyberspace for businesses. And however, as well, they have taken a little bit more steps further, I mean, towards the public, towards wider public sectors, businesses, even academia. We used before, I mean, to have a problem. I mean, if we have a kind of research to reach the police or law enforcement agencies, for example, to collaborate with them in some projects, you know. But now we find them is a little bit easygoing than before, which is as well. I mean, because I think the government, they reached the conclusion that they could not fight the cyber attacks on their own. It has to be a collaboration between, as I said, industry and public sectors, even internationally. I mean,
because businesses have many experts, block
clusters,
yeah.
Absolutely, yes.
Hmm. And then, so Josiah, do you think what's your take on this hacking debate?
Well, I think what's interesting is that, you know, it does feel like the government don't get it. I think one of the ways that you see that is that many public sector computers are still running on Windows XP, which Microsoft ended their security support for many years ago. And, you know, I think that was reflected through the NHS attack we saw recently. That came down to the government scrapping their deal with Microsoft. Their security deal, which is $5.5 million a year, amid austerity, the government decided they didn't want to do that. They would leave that to health trusts, and of course, you know, amid at this time of austerity, many trusts, you know, decided not to invest in that security. So, you know, I think this is quite new terrain. But the fact that we are, you know, running on extremely outdated technology in much of our public sector is, you know, is a massive concern.
So it's not just I mean, because ministers like Liam Fox in that clip there were just saying, oh, it's just you change your password and that'll be fine. The software, actually, the money does help with this too. That's the silver bullet.
Absolutely. I think, you know, it will have to increasingly be seen as part of a security strategy alongside countering terrorism. In some ways, this is a form of new terrorism. You know, the attack on our NHS put people's lives at risk. And although the intention wasn't explicitly political, the implications of it are. And, you know, when you look at the attacks on Parliament, that's extremely political attack on our democracy. And the implications are absolutely huge.
Yeah, okay, because then, Viv, do you find it fascinating that hacking now is also seemingly all-pervasive? Everyone's been under attack lately.
What I find fascinating is how easy it is for politicians like Amber Rudd, who we just heard, to say fairly obvious things that anybody could think of. She says, so the terrorists don't have somewhere to hide. Asa, you mentioned the expression, the necessary hashtag knowledge. I mean, these are nonsense phrases that anyone could come up with. It's the same as when there was a terrorist attack, Theresa May saying, oh, we need to get involved in WhatsApp. And they just think they can drop in these phrases here and there and it's going to make them look as if they know what's going on. When this is the government who, as Josiah rightly says, has pursued an austerity policy, Asa, you said, money does help. Massive euphemism. The lack of money has put us at risk, and it's that issue. And also it's the government who have discredited experts. Where do we go with this? It's completely ridiculous. I'm doing a show at the moment called Anchorwoman, which is at Leicester Square Theatre and the Museum of Comedy next week. And it's about the news and our connection to digital media. And I'm finding with audiences that people are just so frustrated because they're having so much fear pushed at them the whole time. It's very easy. It's a very emotive subject. But what we need are people who really understand about this and are not afraid to talk about what's really going on instead of just using these buzzwords all of the time.
Although if I can bring in something there, you obviously point linking, agreeing with Josiah about austerity and, you know, sort of our cyber defences. But it wasn't quite the same situation in America, surely. And yet the DNC, the Democratic HQ, that was hacked. Emails all over the place from WikiLeaks then. So they got hit. And
there's a sort of opposite problem of austerity there. I'm not speaking as anyone with any inside knowledge on this. But there is money flowing in lots of different directions that is causing that. If you want to look over here and look for a link between here and America, then just Google Cambridge Analytica and you'll see that there's money gone into hacking which potentially affected the referendum.
How so?
You don't know the story of Cambridge Analytica?
Oh, no, I'm very aware. But
yeah. Well, because
but hacking is a very broad term.
Yeah, so but there are specific pockets that are being investigated. For example, The Observer's done a big investigation about this, been done by Carol Cadwallader, that are looking into the links between, say, the businessman Robert Mercer, and who's involved in US politics, and Cambridge Analytica in the UK, which networks are very Byzantine. And we don't really know yet what's gone on, and we don't have proper evidence about it. But there's more and more evidence coming out in these investigations that there has been money flowing around in the background that has caused hacking to affect our democracy. So that's one side of the hacking. And the other side is when it's affecting things like the NHS, which is where austerity does come into play.
Oh yeah, go on, Jazza.
I think the other thing to add is that although there is, as you say, a lot of money flowing around, actually it takes very little, you know, upfront cost to cause a huge amount of damage. You know, you can end up with 14-year-olds in Moscow deciding to hack, you know, NHS systems in Wolverhampton or somewhere. You know, they can do that from their own bedroom, and you can buy packs online from these dark websites where you can do that for very little money by the means of, you know, to buy the means of doing this.
The point is though that they don't just decide to do it off their own bat, being an enterprising 14-year-old, do they? Well, at least don't tell my 13-year-old that. I think we'd be more than happy to try and bring down the Russian government.
Yeah.
But there are sinister players who we don't know enough about yet, who are affecting all of this and affecting our democracy. And to me, it's almost a bit of a smokescreen that we're focusing on the idea of hacking and privacy and cybersecurity as if it could affect us all personally, when in fact we should be focusing and concentrating investigative journalism on these issues that affect our democracy, which are much more fundamental.
If I could bring in Dr. Amir on this, I take it you must have read the sort of Observer's many reports about Cambridge Analytica and the sort of dark web and all the nefarious, allegedly, you know, things that might have been swirling around. To your mind, and this seems to be sort of linked as something that when people say, oh, you hack an election, you hack a referendum, they always seem to point to those reports right now as sort of how it's suggestions and indications and the start of a trail. I mean, do you think that this is right? Do you think this is that there is something odd that going on there?
I mean, this is all these larger scales hacking attacks, actually. You know, this is rarely that done by individuals. Hmm. And mostly, for example, if we could say, for example, organized
foreign actors, foreign,
foreign actors, yeah. Even organized crime and all, for example, or at state level. Hmm. However, as I said, I mean, some of these, for example, like the NHS attacks, I mean, it could not be done by one individual person or a kid, for example, but it has done by, as I said, by a group, for example, of hackers, and all the fingerprints is pointing towards some of the potential suspect to do so. Mm. However, as mentioned, this is, for example, there is always, we have to understand, for example, there is two types of attacks, for example, or the criminals or the hackers. They have a targeted victim or untargeted one. Mm. And like the NHS one, for example, it was like an untargeted organization rather than spreading and damaging all these kind of organization which have, for example, not up-to-date system, which is, or the vulnerability which was in Microsoft, which again, it was discovered long time ago by the American National Agency, and they have developed their own bespoke tools to exploit this kind of vulnerabilities. But because of that was leaked, for example, then afterwards that they have notified the Microsoft. Microsoft, they have patched the system and updated the system and advertised that all the, or announce that all the organization, they have this kind of...
But it's always a bit too sort of late, it seems, after the event.
Yeah, I mean, the average, to be honest with you, that's according to some surveys, the average that between that cyber attacks and batching, for example, the businesses take them 298 days to act on kind of, let's say, vulnerabilities or kind of this kind of attacks, well, as I said, which is really, yeah. I mean, too long, I mean, for the cyber criminal or the hackers to do very much things within a week or within a day.
Hmm.
And we have to remember as well, sorry, this is, I mean, that's always the hackers, or they have more time in hand than the cybersecurity professional themselves to protect. And many factors playing roles, as for example, one of them is the cost of securing a system and so on.
If I can actually take up the point in terms of sophistication of technology as well, I mean, then Josiah, obviously let's talk about the future of war in this case. We were talking about cyber war earlier, we as a panel, and people say during the election, for example, oh, you know, what about, it was all about Trident, that was very key to our security, you know, get the nukes and you're fine. But really, in one way, we're missing out on debate. The real frontier is, you know, British hackers, you know, versus, you know, sort of the Eastern and foreign climates in a way. Because I remember reading one thing about the North Korea en passe. You know, how do we sort of get at them? How does the West get at them? And there was one theory, for example, suggesting that we could, you know, US hacking could sort of disable their nuclear missiles and warheads. And so that could be sort of how these things really are done in the future, rather than bombs and all that.
Absolutely. I think it all wraps up in each other. You know, when our security networks themselves are highly digital now, you know, that's an extra opportunity for foreign states or, you know, even potentially terrorists to have that point of access there. And, you know, I think it is, as you say, a great shame that this was totally not talked about during the election. As you say, we had this, you know, big debates about Trident and, you know, whether we pay 2% of GDP for our military, our armed personnel or not. Actually, we are going to have to treat this as a priority now. And I think the small upside of these recent hacks is that they didn't actually do a huge amount of damage. You know, when Parliament's emails were taken down, it was a couple of days. Okay, they had to use their Gmail accounts. No huge damage there. The NHS attacks, actually, they found that very little was paid out from the NHS to these foreign hackers. Next time, I think there is a real concern that it could be a lot worse. As you say, it takes an incredibly long time with many of the more sophisticated hacks to sort out. And we really need to get preparing for that potential scenario now, much as we're preparing for, you know, the kind of hard attacks that could come from other states.
Mm. I wish they could get somebody to hack into the NHS and steal the £350 million a week. Why can't somebody just do that? Then we can just get the money. I need to develop some hacking potential. Maybe you guys can help me after this. How long would it take you to teach me how to hack in? And maybe you shouldn't answer this.
This is very easy. This is one
afterwards.
Of the problems we are having, actually, for example, because most of the hacking tools are available online for free. For example,
you can show me the websites.
The current software was used to attack the NHS. All this WannaCry actually is sold for just only £6 in the dark.
I've got £6 with me. Let's get on the dark web. Let's do this thing.
But I should say here, sorry, I mean, this is the damage of any cyber attacks is could not really straight away measured, for example, because you don't know the intention of the cyber security. For example, the NHS, for example, they ask just for $350 for the ransomware, but sometimes the aim of that attack, or in many other attacks, for example, try to confuse the victim, but the aim actually to get their data. Imagine, for example, they have all the patients.
They get the medical data and then they can sell it.
They could sell it. They could use it as well against insurance company. They could made a lot of claims. Actually, not just the aim.
Yeah, I've just realised that I would be a very bad hacker because I've just suggested hacking the wrong thing. I was going to hack the NHS, but I need to hack a bank or a source of money
or the tax system
to draw the money.
But actually, speaking of the kind of, as we now seem to be discussing what one would, fantasy hacking practically, I mean, the fact that you seem to be very certain, Dr. Amir, on how easily you could just set yourself up as a hacker, why are the authorities not just sitting on, you know, the website? And I know I'm sounding like Amber Rudd when I'm saying this, you know, necessary hashtags and all. But why are they not sort of, I don't know, somehow just watching what IP addresses go to these websites? Although, if you're saying a dark web, I guess they genuinely can't. They can't just see who's accessing it. And as soon as you buy it or go for it, then you're nicked as such. It's not as easy.
Not as easy at all, because as I mentioned, for example, the dark web is in its own. It is designed to maintain anonymous for the users, for example. And the way is as well that made trading, for example, with bitcoins on these things, for example, this is really difficult to trace. I mean, one of the main cases was about the child abuse website, and the only way that break into this child abuse rings, for example, was by setting up a website on the dark web, the law enforcement, and use it for almost 3 years, I mean, to gain the trust of all these bad guys, for example, to try to identify their real identity. And as I said, this is not really something easy to do, but this is required, as I said, as a collaboration of everyone, not just the law enforcement agencies.
It requires time to infiltrate
Said, I mean, the time as an organization, I mean, they have this one called penetration tester. And in order to invite someone, for example, if I want to go do penetration testing for the whole network, that means will cost me really a fortune. That's why maybe I will choose just a one component of my network to be tested and to scan against any vulnerabilities.
Wow, I love this. I'm going to get you to take me on the dark web. Can I ask Josiah and Amir, as part of your work, because you work in this field every day, I'm fascinated by your insights. What you call the dark web, would people who work in your field, in cybersecurity, you, Amir, as a lecturer, and you, Josiah, as a journalist, is it safe for people to go on the dark web and access it? I, for example, would feel very scared of doing that. I'd feel like I would immediately get arrested.
Absolutely. There's always a bright side of the dark web for their journalists, for example. There's many other countries, for example, they are not the, if they use the normal web or the internet or the indexed website, for example, they will be easy to be traced back. Yeah, but I mean, the dark web as well is actually was mainly for to avoid any tracking or any things of especially journalists from China or other countries. However, as an individual, you could always create an account and you could use it for good things. I mean, not just always bad things. You will see, for example, the dark web people selling drugs, they're selling weapons, they're selling, for example, even the terrorist organization, they have.
But not everyone who uses the dark web is trying to sell drugs on it.
No, not at all. As I said, I mean, this is using dark web is not illegal. Yeah. This is absolutely fine. You could use it as long as you want if you are not trying to do any, let's say, misachieved.
Well, on that point, I think we might wrap up before we get sort of laptops out and start trying to learn all sort of tricks. But so thank you so much, Dr. Amir Al-Namrat, Josiah Mortimer from Left Foot Forward, and Viv Groskop. Thank you again. And so, finally, we can crack on with the last part of the show. And so we've took the streets of Islington around here to find out, before we go to our interview with Baroness Pauline Neville-Jones, what people thought about cybersecurity and many other issues relating to that.
So we work in an IT company, actually, so pretty informed on what's going on. And obviously there's always, I think, a high risk of attacks, but I think there's enough stuff going on behind the scenes with the government and security procedures so that we're pretty safe.
I don't know. I've not the faintest idea.
No, I don't, but I don't know what they should do because I'm a bit clueless on the technology. But I don't think they're doing enough now.
FUBAR Radio is proud to be an official partner of Stand and Calling 2017. This year's festival is taking place from the 27th to the 30th of July, with a lineup which includes
Orbital, Clean Bandit, Slaves, Akala, Nadia Rose,
as well as DJ sets from
Mike Skinner and Merkage, Joe Goddard from Hot Chip,
and Faithless. FUBAR Radio will be bringing the hottest stand-up talent to the brand new comedy stage, featuring James Acaster. For more information and to buy tickets, go to www.standandcalling.com and keep listening to FUBAR Radio for exclusive offers and giveaways in the lead-up to this summer's big event. FUBAR Radio, an official partner of Stand and Calling.
FUBAR Radio presents...
FUBAR Radio presents...
Politics on FUBAR.
Welcome back to Politics on FUBAR. It's Asa Bennett here, and I have the pleasure to have on the line Baroness Pauline Neville-Jones, the former Security Minister, former Chair of the Joint Intelligence Committee. Hello.
Hello.
Now, thank you very much for joining us. Because then, may I say, from your perspective, it must be, I don't know how you must have been feeling sort of the last few weeks, seeing, you know, hacking and cybersecurity continually in the headlines. It seems, you know, Parliament being under siege practically, and the NHS attacked with ransomware. I mean, is anyone safe these days?
Is anyone safe these days?
Yes, I mean, if Parliament, you think they might be able to afford good security if they can be brought down in terms of remote working by hackers?
Well, of course, the security of the parliamentary system, like any system, depends upon the discipline of its users. My understanding is that the reason why the parliamentary system was penetrated was because there were some very weak passwords being used by members of the system. I don't know whether which house they were in or whether they were staff, but certainly people linked into the system, you know, weren't doing the elementary things which can help guarantee safety for everybody. And that's the problem, is you only have to have, you know, one weak password, one failure in the system, and of course it can lead to, you know, the whole network being brought down. And so one of the features of cybersecurity is the shared responsibility, because you have to be, you know, when you join into the network, you're responsible not only for your own security, but you actually affect and are part of other people's security.
So our theory is,
you know, not, I mean, if you lock your house, you know, you're responsible for locking your house. But actually, in the case of cyber, you know, if you don't lock your house, then it's a whole road. It's, you know, much larger organisation that's potentially prejudiced.
And do you think you worked in government, and so you'd have rubbed shoulders with these people who are trying to fend off hackers, keeping us safe? Do you feel that they understood the scale of the challenge?
Well, I think that those who are looking at the threat that we face certainly do understand the extent of the challenge. And they do a great deal to send out information and warnings and to share their information about the threat, the threat picture.
Mm.
The issue is the extent to which people then actually act on that information that they're given. Now, I don't suppose they would say, that they're perfect and they know everything that's going. But there is a gap, undoubtedly, between the knowledge that we have collectively and the extent to which people actually take the precautions necessary.
And that's why they keep getting through.
That's where we have to fill that gap between awareness and action.
But then with awareness, obviously hacking is such a widely used term these days, and that it seems every event in politics now has some nefarious interference going on in the US presidential election. And more recently, Labour MP Ben Bradshaw, I think in the chamber, he suggested that the EU referendum was quite probably hacked. Do you agree with that?
Well, I don't know about the EU referendum. I mean, I just don't have any information to that effect. I mean, I don't exclude it because I don't know, but I don't have information on it. I think it is fairly, it is actually an established fact that the Democratic National Committee was hacked. The Russians deny, of course, doing it, but I think there's fairly widespread
questions about who exactly.
Indeed, they were interested in all of that. One of the issues, of course, is why do people do this? And here there was a political motivation. Some hacks, like the one, for instance, that the NHS was caught up with. It does look very much as if, they launched a piece of malware. They didn't realize how far it would actually spread, and it was financially motivated.
Hmm.
It turned out to be much bigger, I think, than they themselves realized would be the case. And it shows how easily an organization can get caught up in something that's not actually directed at it.
Hmm.
You don't necessarily these days have to be targeted in order to be a victim. In the case of the Americans and what Ben Bradshaw was talking about, here is something that people call hybrid warfare.
Yes.
That's to say, using cyber means as actually for political purposes. And that's when you get into the realm of states using cyber against each other.
I mean, because I know obviously you're not privy to the information that the American services would have, so we may be having a sort of we may be talking out of arm's length about the issues over there. But then if I could bring us back to sort of Britain in one way, I remember during the EU referendum campaign, at least, that you were very robust in talking about the security and how, in striking down the Leave side's arguments that, that the EU was stopping Britain from being safe and secure against threats, be it cyber or...
Well, I stick by that.
Indeed. So do you feel as we are negotiating our way and making our way out of the European Union, there was something that stuck in my mind, which is when Theresa May put in that letter to Donald Tusk, the sort of suggestion that no deal might well throw up intelligence arrangements in the air. I mean, do you think that was a wise decision to mention that? And do you agree that it would be calamitous if there was no deal for intelligence sharing and security?
I think that no deal would harm both sides. It does not make sense to me for the existing cooperation to be damaged in any way, because the benefit is undoubtedly shared. We do help, undoubtedly, continental European security, because our intelligence base is good, and we make information from it available to others who are threatened. The reverse is also true. There is gathering of information in continental Europe from which we benefit, and we benefit also from the extensive police cooperation that goes on. So it's not a good idea actually to sever that or to damage it. And one of the things I very much hope in these negotiations on Brexit is that we will arrive at some agreement. Because a lot of these things, some of them, but a lot of these things don't have anything to do with EU structures. And we ought to be able to continue them, even in the absence of not being a member of the EU. Some of them are EU-related, and we will lose ground, unfortunately, as we leave, because we won't any longer, for instance, be able to head the European Police Organization, Europol, which is very valuable, and we have a Brit there in charge. And that's a loss. It's a pity.
But then, if you look at countries,
we'll have to try and make up for it.
But obviously, there are countries like Norway and those who are sort of semi-out in EFTA, EEA, all sorts of half-in, half-out arrangements.
Yeah.
Do you feel that in Britain that these existing security arrangements would be just as effective in that sense, or is it just the only way is down? The only way is it's less effective.
Well, I find it hard to, frankly, I find it hard to believe that, you know, you are as effective outside as you would be inside. Hmm. For one thing, we won't any longer have the capacity actually to influence further decisions that are taken, or at least be part of the decision-making. We'll be able to influence them, but we won't actually, in the end, be part of the decision-making machine.
Although the Britain
and we have been very powerful in making decisions on security in Europe. And a lot of the airline security, for instance.
But there wouldn't be a divergence of aims.
As a result of direct British action.
There wouldn't be a divergence of aims, surely. I mean, the Britain and the EU27 would still be united against terror and hacking. The principles apply.
I'm not arguing that wouldn't be the case. Hmm. What I am saying is that Britain's comparative position in relation to the decisions that are taken and the institutional developments and, you know, what happens after we leave the European Union, there we are in a less influential position and we don't have any power actually to join in the decisions that are actually taken, though I would hope we would at least be able to influence them. So it does change things. I don't think one can you know, deny that. Mm. What I hope is we can set up structures of a kind where consultation is sufficient, that our ability to at least influence the decisions that are taken is real and forms part of the basis on which then others will then take those decisions.
And one can assume the Prime Minister would obviously agree with you, given her days as a former Home Secretary. She would want to have, and indeed she fought, well, alongside you.
When she was a Remainer, yes. I mean, her argument precisely was that it benefits Britain.
Yes, and so she agrees, indeed. And so with this in mind, and you know, given how she's had to change, be very pragmatic, because you're the only person right now in this conversation who's ever worked with her and knows what she's like in private. I mean, do you think she's got the right sort of temperament and character to handle these Brexit negotiations smoothly?
Well, these negotiations are going to be very tough, and you do need stamina. And one of the things that undoubtedly Theresa May showed when she was Home Secretary was very considerable stamina. You know,
she a bloody difficult woman, as Ken Clark
said. That's very important. It's very important also that she takes the team with her.
Mm.
And you know, that's.
But can she be a bloody difficult woman, as Ken Clark said?
Yes, I think that on the whole, that's correct. But you know, you don't get very far in life unless you're prepared to stand your ground.
Well, I mean, sure, it'll be interesting to what happens. I mean, you must have pity for the EU27 then, you know, when you let her loose on them, you know. No. Well, wisely, no comment there. I can hear. Sort of.
I think it's going to be very important, obviously, that you know, when the negotiations, you know, get going really solidly, and we're still in some ways are sort of limbering up, you know, with the initial bit of the agenda. But when we get into the negotiations for trade and for other relationships. The relationship between individuals really does matter. I mean, I know from my negotiating days, if you can establish a relationship with somebody the other side of the table, you're much more likely to be able to do effective.
And that may be the key challenge for her, sort of being empathetic and getting on with people. And so, all right. Well, in that case, thank you so much for sharing your insights and spending the time, Baroness Paul. Baroness Neville Jones is the correct way to say. Yes. Well, I hope you have a good day, and thank you for your time again.
Thank you. Thank you. Bye.
And so that was Baroness Pauline Neville-Jones, as I will correctly refer to her as. And indeed, thank you very much for listening. By the way, while we've been talking, you've been answering the poll in great numbers indeed. And so with the question being, is Britain safe enough from hackers? I can confirm that 42% of you said actually more protection is needed. 13% said both my passwords are cryptic and my password is password. At least you're wisely thinking about these things. And the rest are saying, I literally have no idea. Well, I'm hopefully thinking that we've, you know, brought insight that means that the number's fallen down over the course of this show. And so in the meantime, to play us out, I can present you the following. No better than Kraftwerk's Computer Love. Goodbye.
This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. Go to FUBARradio.com for more details.